talked last week about the evangelical movement in the 20th century. A different strain of thought during this time, though, was the what I would call like the 20th century movement among liberal universities, the 20th century movement back towards traditional Christianity. So, I mean, N.T. Wright might be an evangelical. I'm not sure. I really don't know where he stands on inerrancy. But basically, these three gentlemen, Wolfhart Pannenberg, a German theologian, N.T. Wright, a British New Testament scholar, and Larry Hurtado, a New Testament scholar at the University of Edinburgh, they're basically trained in liberal or neo-Orthodox settings and established their scholarship, yet the conclusions they drew were much more conservative than the normal neo-Orthodox liberal stance. Because of that, there's a growing movement among European theologians and European New Testament scholars back towards traditional Christianity, in fact, back towards traditional Christology. So we'll start with Pannenberg. He was born in 1928. Last I heard, he's still alive, and a German theologian. He argued that the Christian faith is rooted in history. Now, that doesn't sound really earth-shaking, but it actually was, because Bultmann, his ideas about Christianity needing to be de-myth, that Christianity was filled with, the Bible's filled with myths, we got to get behind the myths, and that sacred history is just a bunch of fairy tale, and if you want to get beyond those myths to the true historical Jesus, you're going to find that Christianity is really not rooted in history. So Pannenberg just turned the tables upside down. And he said, yeah, I believe in sacred history, but all history is sacred history. That God is not just in control of what the Bible talks about. He's in control of all of history. So he accepted the sacred history of Bultmann, but he rejected the idea that there's any other kind of history. So Bultmann had like real history and sacred history. Pannenberg would argue real history is sacred history. God is in control. Therefore, he accepted historical evidences for things such as Jesus' resurrection. Now, this marked a return to taking seriously Christianity's historical truth claims among European scholarship. Nobody is going to claim that Pannenberg is a flake. His scholarship is universally acknowledged, yet he argues that Christianity is rooted in history and that we can provide historical evidence for Christ's resurrection. Now, if you read any of his work on the resurrection, it's not as it's not exactly what I would call full-blown acceptance of the bodily resurrection of Christ. He's more along the lines of a spiritual resurrection. But Gary Habermas has shown that because of Pannenberg's influence and the influence of other New Testament scholars in Europe, that of the world's leading New Testament scholars writing between 1975 and 2003, Dr. Gary Habermas, writing in English, German, and French, Gary Habermas is the only scholar who's read all of these guys, says that I believe it's about 72% of New Testament scholars today. Now, keep in mind, most of these New Testament scholars, a very high percentage of them, I mean, we're probably talking 90, well, the world's leading New Testament scholars, it might be 100% of them, were trained at neo-Orthodox or liberal New Testament departments, yet about 72% acknowledge that Jesus of Nazareth did rise from the dead. Now, a little bit more than half of that 72% acknowledge a full-blown bodily resurrection. The others opt for a spiritual resurrection of some sorts, which of course is not biblical. But whatever the case, the most common view of the world's leading New Testament scholars today is that Jesus did in some way, shape, or form rise from the dead. And the fact that they started as far left as you can get and work their way to acknowledging the resurrection, means that the, you know, the Jesus Seminar, those guys are dinosaurs. Marcus Borg, John Dominic Cross, and these guys are a throwback to an earlier era. And now New Testament scholarship is moving towards traditional Christianity and Christology. In fact, even Marcus Borg acknowledges that the post-resurrection appearances of Christ were what he calls apparitions. So even Marcus Borg of the Jesus Seminar acknowledges, comes pretty close to acknowledging a spiritual resurrection. So you get as far left as New Testament scholarship can get. There's a small branch of New Testament scholarship called the Jesus Seminar. Only a few of those guys, too, about over 200 now that are meeting, and probably only about 30 of them are actually have established their scholarship. The guys who are on the farthest right of the Jesus Seminar come pretty close to acknowledging a spiritual resurrection. I mean, that's the most radical 1% of New Testament scholars, and even some of them are acknowledging some type of resurrection. We know that the evidence is pointing more and more towards biblical Christianity. Now keep in mind, New Testament scholars start with all these biases against miracles. And with that starting point, we're now seeing them end up where people like N.T. Wright are. N.T. Wright is. N.T. Wright is a British New Testament scholar. He argues that Jesus thought of himself as being uniquely God, and that Jesus did actually bodily rise from the dead. He even goes to great lengths in his recent work, published in 2003, The Resurrection of the Son of God, about 650 pages long. He spends several hundred pages arguing that the Greek words for resurrection in the first century AD, whether you were Jew or Gentile, Sadducees who denied the resurrection, Pharisees who believed in a future bodily resurrection of believers, it didn't matter where you stood on the issue. Whenever somebody said resurrection or the raising from the dead, the raising, that it always meant the reanimation of a corpse, that a corpse would be laying down and dead and life would re-enter it, and the person would get up and walk out of the tomb. So, and that's interesting too, because the Jesus Seminar acknowledges that Paul taught that Jesus rose from the dead, but then they'll argue that Paul didn't mean that Jesus' body literally rose from the dead. N.T. Wright proves that there was no other way of looking. Even the Sadducees, who rejected a future bodily resurrection, when they used the word resurrection, they would say, well, that means a body coming back to life. And then they would say, and we don't believe in that. So just based on his work right there, he just destroys the work of the Jesus Seminar. N.T. Wright, by the way, he comes to the area a lot, speaks a lot at Seattle Pacific University, at least once a year. But in 1999, he had a debate in written form with Marcus Borg, who's considered the world's leading liberal scholar from the Jesus Seminar, and that book was entitled The Meaning of Jesus. And you could buy both of these books at Barnes & Noble. They probably have a few copies on their shelves right now. So that's N.T. Wright. And he may be an evangelical. It's really close. It's all going to come down to be a member of the Evangelical Theological Society, you have to believe in inerrancy and the doctrine of the Trinity. It would depend on his views in those areas. Now, Larry Hurtado, from the University of Edinburgh, Scotland, New Testament scholar, he rejects attempts to find early Christian doctrines that predate the New Testament. He rejects those attempts because he says they're too subjective. You know, well, what did the church believe before the New Testament was written? Well, you know, the scholars start saying, well, obviously Jesus really didn't perform miracles. Miracles are impossible. So they had to teach that Jesus just was a philosopher, a sage, who went around teaching. And, you know, Hurtado's sitting back and saying, you guys are looking for teachings, what the church taught before the New Testament was written, and you don't have anything to work with. And so you end up coming up with your own subjective views, and you create a Jesus in your own image. So instead, Larry Hurtado suggests that we examine what we know. And if you go before the New Testament was supposedly written, you have early Christian devotion, the early worship of the church, going back to the early 30s AD, ancient creeds and hymns. And so what he says is, instead of looking for the theology, the doctrines they taught, let's just look at the way they worshiped and see if we can glean anything from this about what their view of Jesus was before the New Testament was written. And so Larry Hurtado does that, and he shows that early Christian devotion involved what he called binitarian worship. Now, he's not denying the doctrine of the Trinity by saying this. I don't even know where he stands on the Trinity, but what he's saying is the earliest worship of the Christian church back to the early 30s AD, they worshiped Jesus alongside the Father in earliest Christian devotion. This comes out in his 2003 work, The Lord Jesus Christ, and another 650-page tome, where he argues you go as far back as you can, almost back to the death of Christ itself, and you have the early church singing hymns to Jesus alongside the Father, praising him. Some of his other writings, too, he asks questions like, is that common in Judaism? And he says, no. I mean, even when you have prophets standing in the place of God, they're not worshipped alongside the Father because that would be polytheism. But yet Jesus, in a strict Jewish monotheistic setting, where they believe in only one God, all of a sudden their views change. So he sees it as a qualification, a slight transformation of monotheism. So it's still monotheistic belief in one God, but somehow you're worshiping two persons, the Son alongside the Father. And I would agree with Hurtado that it took generations, if not centuries, for them to fully figure out where the Holy Spirit fits in. Now, you can see as early as Paul's writings, though, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit spoken about in different blessings and different benedictions as if they're three different persons. So it's kind of like there's a Trinitarian, a little hint of the Trinity, but from the start of Christianity, it's worshiping the Son alongside the Father. The media makes it look like the Jesus Seminar is cutting edge in thought. In reality, these guys are pretty much stuck in 19th century. We're now in the 21st century, and they're stuck in 19th century New Testament scholarship, still trying to come up with hold the same theories that their own liberal scholars refuted over 100 years ago. The newer, the more cutting edge European thought is actually a movement towards traditional biblical and evangelical Christianity. Okay, now what I want to do is spend a little bit of time talking about postmodernism. Postmodernism is kind of interesting in its effect upon the church, and it does warrant mention. Postmodernism is tough to define without giving some historical background to it. You know, there was this thing called modernism, and that was the dominant view among the intellectuals of Western civilization. And that began to give way to what became after modernism, which was postmodernism. So when we talk about pre-modernism, during pre-modern times, you weren't called a pre-modernist, because nobody knew modernism was just around the corner. But in pre-modern time, from ancient Greek thought through medieval times, you know, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, they won the debates. So there were some widely believed assumptions that truth is absolute, there is absolute truth, things that are true for all people in all times and all places, that truth corresponds to reality, the human reason is able to find truth, that the universe made sense, and there's a reality beyond the five senses, what Plato called the forms, the world of the ideas. Now, the Christian worldview fit very nicely into the pre-modern mindset and even confirmed it. So when you have, by the time of Augustine, now the dominant view in the West, in Western culture becomes Christianity. And the Christian worldview taught that an infinite rational God created man in his image and created the universe in an orderly way so that man, through the reason God gave him, could find truth in the universe in which he lived. So the pre-modern mindset was very compatible with the Christian worldview. Now, so what happened was you had this gift from God called reason. And Christians fell in love with this gift and began to use it, and so eventually modern science got jump-started. Because now we had what the Greeks never had. The Greeks, you know, many of the Greeks, because of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, believed that there is absolute truth and man can know it. The problem was they had no guarantee. With the Christian worldview, God is that guarantee. Okay? God is not an evil God who created the world in a way to deceive, and in our senses to deceive us. So eventually modernism arose, and I date that to the life of René Descartes and his work from 1596 to 1650. He was a Roman Catholic, and he tried to prove everything through reason alone. He was not a skeptic, but he used skepticism as a method to find truth. So he said, I'm going to suspend judgment on all things until I find something that I can no longer doubt. So I find some point of absolute certainty. At this point, they were finding the axioms of geometry, and that's what he wanted, a point of total certainty from which to argue for everything else. So he began to doubt and doubt as a method. He didn't really give up his beliefs, but he just doubted. He said, I'm not gonna build my philosophical system of thought until I find something that I cannot doubt. Well, the more he doubted, the more he realized that he was doubting. And doubting is a form of thinking. And so he said, I think, therefore I am. And that became his starting point. They tried to prove everything through that. Now, the problem here is this led to modernism, which is the attempt to find all truth with certainty through unaided human reason. Okay? Blaise Pascal responded, a fellow Frenchman, also a fellow Roman Catholic, contemporary of Descartes. Pascal said, look, if we could prove everything through reason alone and solve all man's problems through reason alone, then there's no need for revelation from God. Now, Descartes intended this to be to start out his defense of Christianity. Okay? Pascal foresaw that this was going to turn out to be one of the ugliest arguments against Christianity. He said, your project, your attempt to find all truth through reason alone is going to backfire. Because if we could find all truth through unaided human reason, through reason alone, then what need is there for revelation from God? So, eventually, modernism failed to find absolute truth and failed to solve man's problems. Every time we find a cure for a new disease, we also find another way to blow up the planet or kill all life on the planet Earth. So modernism failed to find absolute truth and solve man's problems. And so postmodernism is a reaction against modernism because of its failure. So postmodernism rejects absolute truth and human reason's ability to find truth. Now I would argue that postmodernists should go back to premodernism rather than reject it. There's actually a movement, they're very close to postmodernists, so much so that I used to think they were, I thought they were kinder, gentler postmodernists who were open to Christianity and theism and absolute truth and absolute morality. But now some people are calling them transmodernists. Can't even pronounce the name of the guy that did the Signs movie, The Sixth Sense, Village.
M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, how do you pronounce his last name?
Shyamalan.
He's got, in Signs, you have these UFO sightings and these alien sightings, which is mentioned at least twice throughout the movie. This means that everything we thought we knew about science, it gets turned on its head. In other words, modernism failed. It didn't explain this stuff. It acted like everything could be explained through reason alone. Now we got stuff that goes way beyond what our science textbooks teach us. But then instead of postmodern skepticism of all truth, at the end of the movie, the Anglican priest puts his collar back on and the crosses go back on the wall, and he trusts in divine providence, that God is in control, even in the details. And so that's an example of a transmodernist movie where the failure of modernism means we need to go back to pre-modern thought forms. There are many of these guys are becoming theists. They're believing in a personal God. They believe in absolute moral laws, or they're at least open to them. They believe in absolute truth, or they're at least open to it. And some of these guys are actually becoming Christians. But most of the transmodernists at least believe there's a place at the table for traditional people and traditional religions. We need to take a second look. Because the postmodernists themselves, I mean, this is really silly, but the postmodernists, their reasoning goes like this. Modernism disproved Christianity, so Christianity is false. Now we saw that modernism failed, therefore we need to look for an alternative, but we don't need to look at Christianity because modernism proved it false. Well, if modernism failed, the door should be open for Christianity once again. And for postmodernists to assume, no, Christianity is proven false in the past. I mean, that's like saying Joe Schmo is totally unreliable. That other guy over there is a thief. Well, how do you know he's a thief? Well, because Joe Schmo told me. Well, if Joe Schmo is totally unreliable, you need to stop suspecting that this other guy is a thief until you find some good evidence that he's a thief. But whatever the case, we'll talk a little bit about postmodern views. And the reason why this is important for the history of the church is, number one, we've all been influenced by postmodernism. You know, postmodernism teaches that all beliefs are equally true, all behavior is equally wholesome, and that if you disagree with that, you're an intolerant bigot. So when we get a little gun-shy about witnessing to others, it's because we grew up in a postmodern culture. In a postmodern culture, television, the internet, there's more of a focus on images than propositional truth. And so we've all been influenced by postmodernism to a certain degree. Even if we're not postmodernists, we have been influenced by postmodern culture. I mean, we should not feel guilty for sharing our faith with others. That's the most loving thing you can do. Yet, each one of us feels a little bit guilty and intolerant when we start sharing our faith, and that's because of the postmodern culture. But secondly, there are many pastors and theologians who have been so influenced by postmodern thought that they want to blend postmodernism and Christianity. Much of the emerging church movement with Brian McLaren and others, where they're downplaying, they're watering down absolute truth. They don't want to come right out and call homosexuality a sin because that sounds intolerant. I even think guys like John Stott, who was a great evangelical thinker, I even think that he's been influenced by the postmodern new tolerance to the point where he now holds to annihilation of the wicked rather than an eternal torment. So whatever the case, let's look at postmodern views, and then we'll try to respond, and then just talk about the balance that we should have in the church. Postmodernism denies absolute truth. They teach that truth is relative to one's community or social group. And they talk about, you know, since truth gets thrown out the window, all that's left are stories, narratives. And they say there's no meta-narrative, no story that is totally unbiased by a community, a vantage point from which we can look at other narratives and determine which ones are true and which ones are false. Everybody is biased by their community. Let me say this, the last stage of modernism, okay, although some great thinkers refer to postmodernism as ultra-modernism, they don't see it as a break with modernism, but let's just assume postmodernism is a reaction against modernism. Postmodernism focuses on meaning, feelings, and the will rather than on truth and reason. They focus on community. And here's the point I was going to make. They're not individual relativists, but cultural relativists. This is very important. The last stage of modernism, okay, modernism starts with the unbiased, rational individual. Okay? By the time you get to postmodernism, the individual is biased by their community and the narrative of their community, and they're not rational because reasons got thrown out the window. Okay? See, when reason gets thrown out the window and you end up with just the individual, nothing but the individual, an irrational individual, that's the final stage of, you know, of modernism, and that's what's called existentialism. With the individual, you can't find truth through reason, there is no absolute truth, so you create meaning for your life by actualizing yourself, by taking an existential leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm. Postmodernism goes one step further. Not only is reason gone, but the individual is gone. Because the individual is merely a product of their community and their community's narrative. Okay? You see many of these communities, by the way. The gay community is a postmodern community. Liberal theologians are postmodern communists. The women's lib lobby, another group, they're all gathering around a narrative. And see, you know, there's no objective true history, there's no real facts, there's no real reason, so they are free, their community, through their narrative, to deconstruct text, like a text like the Gospels, and read them through the lenses of their own community. So they turn Jesus into a gay activist or into a homosexual himself, and the woman's lib would turn him into the greatest proponent of women's rights ever. And that makes no sense whatsoever, but these people are being looked up to. Now you have professors, postmodern professors, who are thought, wow, he's so brilliant. He believes in a gay Jesus, or that Jesus is the greatest Marxist revolutionary ever. Well, these are postmodernists who are reading their views into history. This is why Elaine Pagels, I think she's influenced by postmodernism, a religion professor at Princeton, where she could read her feminism into the Gnostic writings, which are actually anti-woman. And she could read her feminist views into it and argue that Gnosticism has as much right to be called original Christianity as traditional Christianity. Well, she's really not dealing with true history there. She's dealing with, she believes that she's got the right to twist history into whatever her and her community want it to be. So the focus is on community. They're not individual relativists, but cultural relativists. Each individual is a product of their community. They focus on mystery, beauty, and narrative stories. Again, absolute truth is rejected. They deny absolute morality and have a heavy emphasis on tolerance. It's really crazy too, because in these postmodern times, even though postmodernists are supposed to be moral relativists, we are not in the stage of moral relativism. See, first, our nation started, our culture started believing in God's moral absolutes. Then we entered a stage of no moral absolutes, relativism. When we were in that stage, your neighbor would say, oh, you're a Christian, that's great for you. If that works for you, that's great, but it doesn't work for me. Buddhism works for me. But they would think, you know, all these, you know, Christians have the right to be a Christian, and that's great if you believe that, but I don't believe that stuff myself. But now we've gone from no absolutes. While the postmodernist says there's no absolutes, they actually proclaim new absolutes. So that homosexuality is a positively healthy lifestyle under the new tolerance and the new morality, and Christianity is dangerous. That's why we're intolerant, we're bigots. So even though they claim to be moral relativists, political correctness, the new morality, the new tolerance, whatever you want to call it, postmodernism is actually, they have their own functioning new absolutes. But they claim to deny absolute morality, have a heavy emphasis on tolerance. They reject any dichotomist thinking. In other words, they say that there's no either or. There's no true or false. No distinction between truth and falsehood. No distinction between right and wrong. They reduce all authority to power. See, authority is the right to be obeyed or believed. You've earned that right. Power, on the other hand, is just the ability to make others obey or believe you. So power, you just have the ability to make people submit. Authority, you've earned the right for them to obey or believe you. And they say, well, all authority just reduces to power. Okay? So in the end, even postmodernism itself is just a big power narrative. And so you get power narratives instead of rational arguments. They also argue that we create our own reality through language, that language does not represent truth. There's no truth behind language. So language doesn't point to reality. Language is just a game, just a power game. So, you know, it's kind of like you're saying there is no absolute truth, there is no right and wrong. So if I get enough people in my community, if we get enough power, because there's no authority, we're going to cram our views down your throat. And that's what political correctness is all about. You don't debate abortion. You don't debate homosexuality. They just have a mantra or a cliche, and they just try to shout it louder than anybody else. So in postmodern times, if you control the labels, you've won the debate. We're a culture so caught up in images we can't even think straight. So presidential debates have been reduced to 2-minute sound bites, as if the average American can track the speaker for 2 minutes. I mean, in Lincoln-Douglas debates, they would debate 6 to 10 hours long and sometimes break for lunch. And the people would stand there in the heat of the day and listen to the entire debate. Now we get presidential debates with 2-minute sound bites. So if you control the labels, if the media says, well, we don't want to call the pro-abortionists pro-abortionists because Americans don't like the word abortion, let's call them pro-choice. What Americans oppose to choice? And we don't want to call the pro-lifers pro-life, let's call them anti-abortionists because Americans don't like the prefix anti and they don't like the word abortion. So you control the labels, you win the debate in a postmodern society. Another aspect of postmodernism is deconstruction, where you replace the author or the speaker's meaning with meaning from your own community. So you get black Christology, where Jesus either becomes a black Jesus, or at least a Jesus who fought for minority rights. Liberation theologians, they turn Jesus into the greatest Marxist revolutionary who ever lived. Gay theology turns Jesus into either a gay Jesus, or at least a Jesus who fought for gay rights. That's all deconstruction. The deconstruction is when they write about deconstruction, they hate if somebody deconstructs that writing, their writing. But what are they exempt from it? And so postmodernism has given birth to what's called political correctness, where in the name of tolerance, you can't tolerate any non-postmodernist. let's offer a quick refutation of postmodernism, and then I'll talk about where the church should be. I do think that we may need, you know, if we find out with postmodernists that if we say certain things, if we present the gospel message in a certain way and we start out with certain words, if that automatic, like for instance, there's a big emphasis on tolerance. So if we start out a presentation of the gospel message as, you're going to hell if you don't accept Jesus. Okay, if we know that our audience is primarily postmodern, why push them away in the first sentence? Okay, Princeton, a good portion of the professors at Princeton are postmodern. So Campus Crusade for Christ changed their name to Agape Fellowship. Not because they were ashamed of the name Campus Crusade for Christ, but just the word crusade, that's exactly what Princeton, you know, Ivy League scholars say about Christianity. Christianity is nothing but the Crusades and the Inquisition. See, we're not living in modern days, okay? Modernism is dead, so it's no longer on college campuses. It's no longer Christianity is irrational or Christianity is untrue. A lot of these professors don't even believe in truth anymore. So the key is Christianity is intolerant. Okay? A lecture I gave on is Christianity intolerant deals with that issue. Whatever the case, the refutation of postmodernism, it is self-refuting. The statement there is no absolute truth makes no sense unless it's a claim, a truth claim, claiming that the statement there is no absolute truth is a true statement. Okay? So the only way for the statement there is no absolute truth to be true would be if it's an absolute truth, but then it would have to be false. So it's a self-refuting statement. Also, to say there's no such thing as wrong, well then what the postmodernists will do is to say, look, there's no such thing as wrong, therefore, you Christians are wrong to try to have your views taught in the public schools. But wait a minute. If there's no such thing as wrong, then Christians are never wrong. The statement is wrong. It is morally wrong to call any action morally wrong because there is no such thing as morally wrong. It's a self-refuting statement. They reject moral absolutes while creating their own new moral absolutes. You know, in the name of tolerance, they can't tolerate anybody who disagrees with them. The traditional liberals, freedom of speech and freedom of religion meant you can voice your views even if you disagree with me, and you're free to worship even if you're from a different religion. Well, the postmodernists now, all of a sudden, freedom of speech only applies to those who agree with them. So in the name of tolerance, it's become one of the most intolerant worldviews in mankind's history. They say that language does not touch reality. Well, then their language, the language of the postmodernists, the language the postmodernists speak, does not touch reality. So what they're saying is without meaning. They claim every community has its own narrative, and there's no meta-narrative from which their narratives can be judged. But if that's true, then they cannot escape their own community's narrative to critique the narrative of another community. In other words, the postmodern community has no special vantage point from which to condemn the views of any other, the narratives of any other community. So, I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If there is no absolute truth, there is no absolute truth. I mean, the postmodernists can't argue for the truth of postmodernism. While condemning the meta-narrative, postmodernism has itself become a meta-narrative. See, postmodernism is kind of the rejection of all worldviews, but the rejection of all worldviews is itself its own worldview. And then they say they're against dichotomous thinking, yet they divide all people into two groups, those who accept dichotomies and those who don't. They don't accept dichotomies, yet they themselves are a dichotomist, because they say, well, there are people who believe in truth and falsehood, and then there's people like us who know that there's no distinction. Well then they're a dichotomist themselves. They separate the world into two camps. they fail to give us any reason to be postmodern. If they try to give us reasons to be postmodern, they've refuted postmodernism. Because rational debate is supposed to be over. And, you know, it's like J.P. Moreland said when he was speaking in Bellevue, once you throw rational argumentation out the window, all that's left is screaming. And so, like, you know, Bill Clinton, they referred to him as our first postmodern president. So he had a big debate about what the word is means when he got caught in adultery. If you disagreed with him, instead of refuting your ideas, he immediately attacked your person and set his pit bulls after you. And so when reason is thrown out the window, all that's left is shouting. While proclaiming tolerance, postmodernists cannot tolerate any non-postmodernist. So, you know, it's like J.P. Moreland said, postmodernism is a vehicle for angry people who hate tradition to attain positions of power to overturn tradition. Okay? So the woman's lib lesbian gains a position of power and then tries to force her immorality on everybody else while calling them intolerant. Okay? See, traditional tolerance was freedom of religion and freedom of speech. You're free to disagree with others and not be thrown in prison if you didn't break any laws. The new tolerance is the belief that all views are equally true, all behavior is equally wholesome, and, by the way, if you disagree with us, you need to be locked up, your property needs to be confiscated, whatever. So the new tolerance is not tolerant at all. So that's a refutation of postmodernism. What we're going to do next week, we'll look at how the church should respond to postmodernism. We're going to see that Jesus said in John 4:24 that God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. God wants us to worship him with passion from the depths of our being, okay, with our will, but he also wants us to worship him in truth, in accordance with the truth he's revealed. And we'll see that we have to witness as well, speak the truth in love, and that we may want to emphasize some things with postmodernists, emphasize other things with modernists, but we may need to change our method, but we can never change the message. It's the faith once for all delivered to the saints. A lot of churches right now that call themselves evangelical are becoming postmodern.